Good morning. This is a very special day here at the Village Zendo, and it's great to see the room so full of practitioners. Today, directly after this talk, we will honor one of our founding members who passed away toward the end of last year, Jack Baju Poggi. And it's wonderful that his wife and chief caregiver, Jean Lee, could be with us today. And Ramona, who I saw so often on Sundays when Jack, Jean Lee, and I would sit together. And I'm just so flooded with memories on this occasion. So many old-timers back from the days when we were sitting in the apartment are here. I know I'm going to leave people out, so my eyes just happen to fall here and there, and I'll mention a few. Shinko is here, Anzan, Kaku, Howard, and of course we have Shinryu and Miyoko Sensei, Ugetsu, and Soten. I see Soten there. So this goes back, and 30 years or thereabouts. And of course, as some of you may know, we had a little uptown branch of the Village Zendo going for the last 7 years. Part of that was Eisho Sensei, Miyoshin Taylor, Ugetsu, I believe Yuka came from time to time. So I'm going to cut the long list of names, but as I see all your faces, I'm just so overwhelmed by the powerful heart of the Sangha and the way our interconnection has held us through all these years. And it's very appropriate that we're honoring Baiju today, because one place where I really connected with Baiju is that Zen practice made us extremely cross a lot of the time. I remember sitting in the apartment, and I don't know, Baiju would often be sitting near the kitchen, as I recall, and he always sat beautifully. He practiced yoga, and since he was an actor, he took great care of his physical instrument. And so he always sat with good posture, but he had very little patience for the rituals and forms. And it wouldn't take much. He had a wonderful temper. And so I can remember many times, looking at him in the Zendo, and he'd be sitting in this perfect posture, and I felt I could see the steam coming out of his ears. And Zen makes a lot of people cross, and both practitioners and non-practitioners. I run into this, you know, all the time, because it seems to be very smart-ass sometimes, you know. I know something you don't know, and I'm not going to tell you, and I've got it, and you and you don't. I was talking to a friend of mine at the gym last week, and I had to use this big staff to balance myself. And she knew I did Zen and was interested from time to time. And I said, yeah, you know, Zen teachers get the big staff, and you know, there's even a con. If you have a staff, I'll give you a staff, and if you don't have a staff, I'll take a staff away from you. She said, what's that supposed to mean? And I said, boy, she'd make a great koan student. you know, what's that supposed to mean? One of our very senior students regularly comes into interview. What is this? Why is this supposed to help? Practicing for years, very senior. And of course, our study text, the Song of Jewel Mirror Awareness, gets right at this very unsatisfying quality of Zen. It says, the Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Keep it well. Well, that's the good news. You have it. There it is. Keep it well. But then the qualification starts setting in, and it says, don't get too excited about finding it. If you're excited, it becomes a pitfall. If you miss it, you fall into retrospective hesitation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a mass of fire. So here is the frustrating nature of Zen in spades. You've got it, but if you seek for it, you miss it. On the other hand, if you say, oh, no, I'm not going to seek, I'm just going to be right here as I am, that's not going to do it either. And so Zen seems to be a very no-win proposition. And it has been going all the way back to, you know, to the 8th century in China. We have the famous case of Joshu Kanchen, who once asked his teacher Nansen, what is the way? Nansen answered, ordinary mind is the way. Then should we direct ourselves toward it? Nansen said, if you try to direct yourself toward it, you go away from it. Joshu continued, quite understandably, if we do not try, how can we know it is the way? All right? If we don't try to touch it, to reach it, how can we know it's the way? Okay, you can say we have it, but what is it? How do I get it? How do I understand it? How do I grasp it? Manson replied, "The way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is illusion. Not knowing is blankness. If you really attain to the way of no doubt, it is like the great void, so vast and boundless. How then can there be right and wrong in the way?" So listen to what Nansen's saying here. It is like the great void, so vast and boundless. Well, what is it that is like the great void, so vast and boundless? Ordinary mind is like the great void, so vast and boundless. So normally when we think in terms of our individual ego, vast and boundless means something like, 2001 Space Odyssey, galaxies and so on. But when we let go of our ego perspective and stop comparing everything to ourselves, the great void, so vast and boundless, can be a round cushion sitting on a black mat. It can be the sound of clackers telling us it's time to get up. In the case of Baiju, it could be a song and a dance. Vast and boundless. In terms of what? When we let go of our ego conception, vast and boundless can be the size of a head of a pin, or it can be the 2001 thing. So there's a commentary on this koan by Master Mumon, and he says, "Questioned by Joshu, Nansen immediately shows that the tile is disintegrating, the ice is dissolving, and no communication whatever is possible." So what Master Mumon is doing here is he's pointing to the quality of ordinary mind, the way it's completely mutable. We observe this, you sit for 5 minutes on your cushion and you can see your ordinary mind changing moment to moment to moment to moment. And yet also a component of that is an awareness that seems not to change. The tile is disintegrating, the ice is dissolving. The tile is always disintegrating, the ice is always dissolving. So how can there be any fixed state or object known as the way? How can there be a stationary marker off in the distance that we can trudge toward and reach? If we listen to what Nansen is saying, when we set out on the journey, the first trudge is the way, vast and boundless. And midway, as we're starting to get tired, our fatigue is the way, vast and boundless. And when we finally get to that marker, we find, it's still the way, vast and boundless. There really wasn't a marker. There was nothing to reach at all, nothing outside of practicing the great and boundless way, moment to moment to moment. There's a story about nonsense teacher Matsu from the days when he didn't get this. It's quite a famous one. Many of you have heard it. Matsu was physically a very vigorous practitioner, tremendous stamina, tremendous energy, and he just vowed to do Zazen night and day until he finally reached it. He didn't even bother going to the Zendo. He stayed in his hut doing Zazen. His teacher, Nanyue Wei Rong, noticed, where the hell is he? So he went to the hut, and there was Matsu sitting with the sweat pouring off him in the middle of the cold, cold night. And Nanyue said, "What the hell are you doing?" And Matsu said, "Zazen." Nanyue said, "What are you doing Zazen for?" "To become a Buddha." And there was a piece of broken tile on the ground, and Nanyue picked it up, started polishing it on the sleeve of his robe. Matsu said, "What are you doing?" Nanyue said, "I'm polishing this tile." And Matsu said, "Why are you doing that?" And Nanyue said, "To turn it into a mirror." And Matsu said, "How can you make a mirror by polishing a tile?" Nanyue said, "How can you become a Buddha by doing Zazen?" There is no milestone marker out there called enlightenment, Buddha, Buddha nature. No, when we do Zazen, and our Zazen is vast and boundless. When we do Kinhin, we do Kinhin, and our Kinhin is vast and boundless. When we walk down Broadway and go into the subway, our walking and our descent is the great way, vast and boundless, never separate from our lives, even for a moment. So Matsu didn't know that the tile was dissolving, that the Buddha way is always dissolving and appearing, that there's no fixed point to reach. The playwright Tom Stoppard put it very well. He said, "Because children grow up, we think a child's purpose is to grow up. But a child's purpose is to be a child. Nature doesn't disdain what lives only for a day. It pours the whole of itself into each moment." So it's not that there isn't growth and development over the years in Zen practice, but nature, the Buddha way, pours the whole of itself into your practice at each moment. So, moment by moment, things go by. I came into practice back in the apartment, and I was a fool. And then the years went by one, and finally, I became an old fool. And I'll keep walking and appreciating this dissolving and reconstituting tile. Dogen Zenji warns us that bondage to Buddha means being bound by the view that our perception and cognition of enlightenment is actually enlightenment. In other words, whatever the idea we have of enlightenment is, that's what binds us in our practice. That's our obstacle. He says, experiencing such views, even for a moment, you cannot expect to meet liberation, and you will remain mistaken. So what is it? A song and a dance, the changing sangha, the look in people's eyes. The village zendo itself is a dissolving tile. Barely any trace of that small group sitting in a village apartment remains. And yet it is fully present. If we do not set up enlightenment and delusion, I think we're lucky enough to experience life as Master Mumon points out in his commentary on the koan of Joshu, an ordinary mind. Master Mumon says, hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, the snow in winter. If there is no vain cloud in your mind, there is no bondage to Buddha or enlightenment. If there is no vain cloud in your mind, for you, it is a good season.